You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
The words taxation and human rights are not commonly associated with one another. Having said that, listeners may remember Mrs. Justice Whipple described the first case that Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued before the US Supreme Court, Maritz and Commissioner of Internal Revenue, vividly brought to life by Felicity Jones in the movie On the Basis of Sex. That case concerned an unmarried man, Charles Maritz, who cared for his 89-year-old mother, and he argued that it was unfair to deny him a tax deduction when a single woman in the same situation would be entitled to the tax break. The result of that case was an illustration of the importance of rights law in matters of taxation. Here with me to talk about a different side of taxation and human rights is Isabel McArdle from 1 Crown Office Row. Isabel, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me.
So tax and human rights, not natural bedfellows, but perhaps you're going to tell us why that's wrong.
Absolutely. It struck me that this might be quite an interesting topic because a lot of our listeners probably practice human rights in perhaps more obvious and more conventional areas, things like prison law, immigration law and similar. And they might be thinking, well, why does a sort of very commercial, very hard law area like tax have anything to do with human rights? But actually, I think it's a good illustration of the way that human rights law has really permeated right across all sorts of areas of our legal system. And it can have pretty profound effects. So I think there's really two particular articles which are of relevance in tax law.
And those are articles from the European Convention of Human Rights, Article 1, Protocol 1, and Article 6.
Yes, absolutely.
For those not familiar with those articles, can you just briefly remind listeners about their background?
So Article 1, Protocol 1, the right to property, has really three elements. It's probably helpful just to break it down into a bit of detail. So the first element is every natural or legal person, that's things like companies, trusts and so forth, is entitled to the peaceful enjoyment of his possessions. And one of the questions that comes up quite commonly and actually is relevant in tax law is what is a possession? So a lot of the time that's pretty obvious. I think we all feel instinctively like we know this object that I bought is my possession, this land that I have registered at the land registry is my possession and so forth. But it does get a bit more complicated when we think about rights which are not tangible. So an application which arises in tax law is when there are licenses or what are sometimes called approvals to trade in a particular area.
And could you give us an example of a typical license or approval?
Sure. So not just restricted to the tax sphere, but things like licenses to run a business or licenses to engage in a particular trade give rise to questions as to whether or not they really are possessions for this purpose. So, for example, there's a UK case called Malik in the United Kingdom that went to the European Court, which considered the authorization to practice as a doctor in the NHS. And I think that in that case, they found that, in fact, it was not a possession for those purposes. There are quite a few cases where a license or an approval to engage in a particular trade has been found to be, or at least has been assumed to be, by the parties, and the analysis in the court has gone on to decide the case on the basis that that is correct. It's not settled whether or not there is a definitive list of which approvals and licences are going to be possessions and which aren't. There's certainly, from the tax sphere, a Court of Appeal case called CC&C, where there was a question about whether or not approvals, which HMRC, our tax authority, grants for businesses to trade in duty-suspended alcohol trade, were possessions, and there was doubt expressed by, I think, Lord Justice Underhill in that case as to whether or not they really were, because the usual argument is that it's really the business or the goodwill in the business which is the possession, and the approval or the license is just something that you require in order to operate it, but it isn't really our possession for these purposes. But having said that, there are, as I say, cases in which the European Court has found there is a possession. Very, very broadly, I guess, you're more likely to succeed in showing that whatever this right is a possession if you can say things like, well, I have a lot of goodwill in my business and that will all be lost if I have my approval taken away or taken away for a long time. You can show that the business has a particular value, but it's very much tied to demonstrating that the business really is a possession or has a particular value. It's quite difficult just to say that the registration or the approval or the license in itself is a possession.
And you mentioned there were two other parts intrinsic to Article 1, Protocol 1. What are those?
Sure. So just to go on, the first paragraph reads, no one shall be deprived of his possessions, i.e. have them taken away, except in the public interest and subject to the conditions provided for by law and by the general principles of international law. So taking away your possessions is really, I guess, the most extreme interference you could have with your possessions. And unsurprisingly, the ECHR imposes restrictions on when you can do that. It's not that you can't do that if you're a government or public body, but you've obviously got to demonstrate it's in the public interest. There've got to be conditions imposed by law. You can't just arbitrarily decide that you're going to do it. But paragraph two, this third limb, continues with, I guess, a sort of limiting provision. The preceding provision shall not, however, in any way impair the right of the state to enforce such laws as it deems necessary to control the use of property in accordance with the general interest. So if you're using your property in a way that harms other people, for example. And the final part of that paragraph is to secure the payment of taxes or other contributions or penalties. So there's an express carve out, unsurprisingly. The government can interfere to a very great extent with your money if that means that they're able to enforce you paying your taxes. Now, the conventional line that's always been run in the court, unsurprisingly, is that as a general rule, the court will stay out of the state's very wide margin of appreciation in relation to which taxes it imposes and why and so forth, provided that it meets a test of essentially not being arbitrary, devoid of reasonable foundation, is in accordance with the law and so forth. So the starting point is, from a tax perspective, it's quite hard to use A1P1 to say, this tax is unfair, I shouldn't be subject to this tax. But of course, that doesn't mean that there aren't exceptions. So first of all, the requirement of lawfulness is obviously very much built into the article. If it can't be shown that the domestic law actually does apply in this particular situation, but your money has been taken under the name of tax, you may well have case. The law mustn't be arbitrary. It's got to be precise, foreseeable, accessible. So you've got to be able to work out essentially what your tax liability is going to be. It can't be completely unpredictable. That doesn't mean, of course, that there aren't elements of discretion that the state can exercise in relation to tax law. And, of course, there's a proportionality test as well, that the state has to be able to show that a fair balance has been struck, essentially, in its tax legislation. There shouldn't be a disproportionate or excessive burden imposed upon any particular taxpayer. But that doesn't necessarily mean just because there's a less intrusive measure that exists that the government is always, or the legislature is always, bound to impose that solution. It's obviously quite a wide margin of appreciation in this area, as you can probably imagine.
And presumably there are examples of individuals challenging the tax system on the basis of Article 1, Protocol 1.
Yes, absolutely. Many, with varying degrees of success. I mean, to give just one example, there is a case called Buffalo, in which Italy had delayed the reimbursement of overpaid taxes, and that was found to be a violation of A1P1. There were quite long delays, these. I think there were something like 5 to 10 years. There wasn't really proper compensation because all the taxpayers could get was sort of simple interest, and that didn't really put them back in the financial position they would have been in. And they didn't have any real legal avenue of redress other than complaining about their human rights. So that's the kind of practical application of where it arises. And actually, it's a very similar sort of argument as is argued in relation to Article 6, the right to a fair trial. Now, as you can imagine, these two arguments very commonly come together in the same cases, are packaged almost as the same argument, but pursuant to the two different articles. Just to remind our listeners, Article 6, of course, provides that in the determination of a person's civil rights and obligations or any criminal charge, everyone is entitled to a fair and public hearing within a reasonable time and by an independent and impartial tribunal established by law. So you can see how the same kinds of arguments about, for example, where I have paid tax, which I should never have had to pay, in fact, there's been a mistake. There's a long delay in my getting that back. I don't have any legal avenue under domestic law to pursue it. How you could argue that both A1, P1 and Article 6 came into play meant that there'd been an interference with my rights and therefore there should be a remedy pursuant to human rights law.
And in terms of how such arguments have played out in the UK, can you describe to us any of the cases where these two articles have been successfully used by individuals alleging breaches of their human rights?
Yes, there's certainly been some pretty interesting developments in the last few years. I'm going to have to get a little bit technical here, so do forgive me for that. So in the field of alcohol trading, there is unfortunately a lot of fraud. The excise duty on alcohol is pretty high, and so if wrongdoers can get away without paying that, they can make an awful lot of money because the cost of the alcohol itself and whatever goes into it, the, you know, strawberries, water, whatever it is really not that high. The glass bottle is not that high. Most of what you actually pay when you buy alcohol is the duty. So it's a high-risk fraud area. And there have been a number of different domestic measures taken in order to try to prevent fraud in this field. One of them is a system of approvals. And in the last few years, there's been a new legislative scheme brought in whereby wholesalers of alcohol, duty paid alcohol, so where the duty has already been paid on that, on those goods, have to be registered and approved by HMRC, the tax authorities. And in order to get your approval, HMRC has to deem you, pursuant to that legislation, to be a fit and proper person. Now, you can obviously not be fit and proper for really any number of reasons, but the common ones are things like not doing very good due diligence, having a director who has been found to have committed some dishonesty offence. Things of that nature are the typical types of reasons why you might be deemed not fit and proper.
For me, this really does conjure images of Tom Hardy and Peaky Blinders and sort of back rooms of warehouses where gin is being made illegally. But can you give us some modern day and non-fictitious examples of how this has actually played out in the courts?
Absolutely. So there's been a really... It's given rise to some really interesting case law in the last couple of years. So this scheme, as I say, it came in a few years ago. And the consequence was, well, two things. There were people who were not already trading in duty paid alcohol, and they might apply for their approval and then be denied approval. And they have an appeal to the first tier tribunal in order to challenge that if they seek to exercise it. But there were also people who were already trading in duty paid alcohol before this scheme came in and already had businesses. And if they applied and were refused, their arguments are, well, hang on a minute, I was already doing this. I already have a business. I have a possession in that business. And now I can't trade anymore. And HMRC may have good reasons for that or may not, but their route of challenge was to go to the first tier tribunal. The first tier tribunal doesn't have any power to grant an interim remedy saying they can continue to trade, continue to operate their business until this dispute's been resolved before the first tier tribunal and we've got a decision about whether HMRC was entitled to find that they were fit and proper or not fit and proper, as the case may be.
So that presumably puts wholesalers who have established businesses in quite a difficult situation.
Well, that's absolutely what they argue. So what's happened is a series of them have gone to the High Court and sought interim injunctions seeking to be approved temporarily pending the outcome of their first-tier tribunal appeals. And they have generally made those arguments on the basis of my Article 1, Protocol 1 rights or my Article 6 rights have been infringed upon unlawfully. This has culminated in some case law which has gone to the Court of Appeal. Confusingly, in the Court of Appeal, it's called ABC Limited, but by the time it gets to the Supreme Court, it's called OWD Limited. But it's really all the same arguments, but there were a number of different traders involved, and for some reason the name has changed by the time we get to the Supreme Court. So the case comes to the Court of Appeal, and the difficulty is this. On the one hand, you might think, well, there are very good arguments that Article 6 says these traders are not able to trade until however long it takes to get to the first tier tribunal, and if they win, they may well get their approval, but that could be 2 years down the line, by which point they say, I've lost my business, I've lost all my customers, in effect, I've lost my possessions. The flip side of the argument is, well, first of all, there are often factual arguments about whether or not their business really, whether the goodwill is worth a certain amount of money, whether or not they really will lose their business and so forth. But the really big point is the legislation only allows HMRC to grant an approval to trade in this area where they are satisfied the individual or the company is fit and proper. So if the High Court is going to grant an injunction, or if HMRC is itself going to grant a temporary approval, what's happening is HMRC is granting an approval where they don't think someone is fit and proper, at least not in the long term, and the legislation on its face doesn't appear to allow that to happen. So quite interesting arguments were raised about how the legislation has to be interpreted in accordance with these human rights requirements to ensure that people were able to get an effective remedy, they were able to get their case heard before they lose their business. And the Court of Appeal found that the High Court can grant an injunction in order to protect Article 6 rights. It came up with a test, which is pretty hard to satisfy, but the test is essentially they have to obviously first ask HMRC for temporary approval. They have to seek expedition in the first-tier tribunal, which means ask the first-tier tribunal to hurry up and get their case on as soon as possible. And then if they make their application for the injunction, they need compelling evidence, compelling, that the appeal would be ineffective. So what that means is, you don't just turn up with a witness statement from your director saying, woe is me, it's going to be very difficult if we aren't able to trade for a year. You have to have essentially an independent expert who is really analysing the effect on your business and how you will suffer, and it has to be a pretty sort of profound effect before you're going to be able to be successful in relation to this type of application. You also have to show, you know, lots of material to show the merits you have in your appeal. You can't just turn up and say, my business is going to be horribly affected, if in fact it looks like HMRC had a very good reason for finding you were not fit and proper. So a pretty stringent test, and it also found that HMRC had the power to grant a temporary approval as well. So the Supreme Court found that HMRC doesn't have a temporary approval power, so it overturned the Court of Appeal on that point. But interestingly, the grounds of appeal to the Supreme Court did not challenge the High Court's power to grant an interim injunction. And just to reinforce this point so it's clear, what the Court of Appeal found the High Court can do is order HMRC to say, you can trade, you've got an approval, even though the legislation says HMRC can only do that where they think someone is fit and proper. So the High Court is saying, HMRC, go and approve this person that you think is not fit and proper, even though the legislation only gives HMRC the power to do it when they think the person is fit and proper. So an interesting issue. But that point didn't go to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court, unsurprisingly, wanted to comment on it anyway. So all this is obiter and is still up for arguing, but the Supreme Court essentially expressed some doubts, subject to the fact they hadn't heard full argument, about whether or not the High Court really could injunct a public body to do something which legislation says it doesn't have the power to do. A really interesting question, and one that's absolutely still, I think, to be resolved. So at the moment, if you are a trader, if you have had your approval pulled and you were trading before the scheme came in, well, a question mark, how many of those that can really be still around? Perhaps none. But this may well transfer across to other approval and licensing regimes. At the moment, there is a route to get your interim approval by applying to the High Court and by satisfying a very difficult test to satisfy, but nevertheless one that on some facts will be satisfied. Question mark whether or not that will still be in play. And I certainly know that similar arguments about the High Court granting interim relief of this type of nature have been made in cases about things like VAT registration. And there is probably scope for them to be argued in relation to quite a lot of other sort of licensing and approval schemes.
Listeners, next question may not be, but I will ask it anyway. What effect Brexit is likely to have on all of this?
They probably thought they'd managed to get through a whole podcast without having to hear about Brexit. Well, of course, the answer remains. None of us really know at the time of speaking anyway. But it's worth saying that, first of all, for listeners who don't know, quite a lot of tax law is EU law. So VAT in particular, there is an awful lot of EU legislation that is relevant in relation to VAT. And lots of other areas of tax are heavily influenced by or almost completely EU law. So there is a big question mark about what effect Brexit is going to have on tax, and it's probably one of the most heavily affected areas. But it's also worth saying that quite a lot of the EU law arguments that are raised in the tax field also could be argued as human rights, ECHR rights. So things like, for example, the principle of legality, which says essentially that you can't impose taxes without, you know, proper law that's implementing those taxes. The principle of effectiveness, which means that you have to be able to protect your rights in relation to tax by actually being able to appeal in time, being able to, you know, get before the court in time, it not being, in practice, completely impossible for you to protect your rights, which derive from EU law. A lot of those types of arguments could be framed, or very similar arguments could be framed, I think, as ECHR arguments instead. And so it may be that, assuming that we come out of the EU, again, by the time this goes out, who knows what will be happening, but assuming that that is happening, it may be that we start to see ECHR arguments argued quite a bit more in tax, because those EU arguments may no longer be available, or they may be quite different, because we just don't know what tax law is going to look like when we come out of the EU. So it's a really interesting developing area, which is subject to an awful lot of change, probably in the next few years because of Brexit. And it absolutely might be the case that tax law becomes much more an area in which human rights arguments are being raised.
Isabel, thank you for coming on the podcast and telling us all about that.
Thank you very much for having me.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.